I want to read for you the first part of this lecture tonight because it's introductory and I hope carefully written, and then we'll move into a look at the resurrection material. Tonight and the next few nights, we will leave behind our study of Jesus' actions and his words and the way his disciples understood him or came to understand him in his earthly ministry. We'll return to this in a month's time. Our intention in this period of our inquiry is to open ourselves to the thought of Jesus' disciples concerning Jesus in the existence that he entered into through his death. And to do this, we must all be prepared for an imaginative and mental leap. From one point of view, we are still examining historical data, for our attention is on Jesus' disciples in the period after his death, and on their real experiences. But from another point of view, we're going beyond empirical reality. Jesus' disciples, as we will see, understood their experiences as convincing proof of his continuance in an existence, in a life beyond death. Their experiences and their consequent conviction are matters of history. Their conclusions, however, take us beyond the empirical sciences and beyond the kind of language that is appropriate for speaking of what we know about our present existence. They believed that Jesus was still alive after his crucifixion in an exalted existence with God. They believed, moreover, that the living Jesus was influencing their lives and continuing the mission that he had while on earth. How were they to find words to express their faith understanding in regard to Jesus? Naturally, we should expect that their language would be less empirical, more imaginative, more poetic, more symbolic. How else can we speak of something that lies beyond space and time as we know it? They existed in place and time. Real things happened to them, and they understood these happenings in the light of Jesus. That much is fact. When, however, they attempted to communicate their understanding of the implications that these facts had for Jesus in his exalted state, of course they had to use words, but they had to use them in highly symbolic ways, realizing the poverty of the tools that they were using. People, if you'll pardon the comedy, people who read the literature we're about to examine the way they read road maps are not yet ready for a license. Tonight, and in the few following weeks, far more than up till this stage in our inquiry, we must contemplate the gospel portraits in all humility and allow the wonder of their inspired art to draw us into what in the final analysis is beyond words. In this way, we may be able to capture some of the lively faith of their authors and recognize some of our own experiences in theirs. The gospel literature dealing with the period after Jesus' death is rich, but there's little of it. That which centres on the empty tomb is simpler because it's dealing with something that's part of our world. It's also secondary, for its meaning depends on the experiences that the disciples had of Jesus. Now, when we turn to the scenes that focus on Jesus, we find that the gospel according to Mark, strictly speaking, has nothing. The Markan conclusion, which is Mark 16:9-20, has its own perspective, but the material derives from the other Gospels. The Gospel according to Matthew has only one short passage portraying an encounter with Jesus on a mountain in Galilee. That's Matthew 28:16-20. We're told that the 11 saw him, fell down before him, though some hesitated. Jesus commissioned them to continue his work and promised to be with them. We might wonder what it means when they said they saw him. And why is it stated that some hesitated? Turning to the Gospel according to Luke, we find two scenes, both related to Jerusalem. The first is about two disciples journeying from Jerusalem to Emmaus. Someone joins them. We're told that it's Jesus. He walked by their side, we're told, but their eyes were prevented from recognizing him. That's Luke 24:15-16. Are we to understand that Jesus, in his life beyond death, has all the qualities that we now associate with a living person, even perhaps the same shaped body, but that his face or voice was somehow different? The scene goes on to portray Jesus as explaining the scriptures to them while their hearts were burning within them. They invite him to dine with them, and it reads, "Now while he was with them at table, he took the bread, he said the blessing, he broke it, and handed it to them. And we're told their eyes were opened, and they recognized him, but he'd vanished from their sight." Finally, they went to the 11 assembled with their companions, told their story, and were told in turn, "Yes, it is true. The Lord has risen and appeared to Simon." The symbolism, especially of the journey, of the Eucharist, and of the authority in the community, is fairly obvious. The question arises as to the nature of the experience and its implications in our understanding of the kind of existence enjoyed by Jesus after his death. In his second portrait, Luke presents Jesus with the assembled community. As in Matthew, there's some hesitation. We're told that doubts were arising in their hearts. Jesus reassures them that it really is himself and shows them the wounds that he bore for them. And to prove that he's not a ghost, but truly alive, he invites them to touch him and he eats with them. Are we might ask, from this to conclude that our hands can actually touch the body of a person who is in the life beyond death? Is that what Luke is saying? Are we to conclude that Jesus has the capacity to eat and digest the kind of food we eat? Is Luke asserting that? Or is that the imagery he uses to assert that what they experienced was indeed someone who was alive and not a ghost from the underworld? In his conversation with them, Jesus opened their minds to understand the scriptures. He spoke of the gift of the Spirit and the power of forgiveness, and he commissioned them to carry on his mission. And finally, he withdrew from them, was taken up into heaven. Once again, the symbolism is fairly clear. Our question centres on the nature of the experiences portrayed so beautifully in this rich literature. And finally, the Gospel according to John also has two scenes, which you'll recall, but I'll bring them to your mind now. The first is a personal encounter between Jesus and Mary of Magdala. We're told, quotation, that she saw Jesus standing there, though she did not recognize him. In fact, she comes to recognize him only when he calls her by name, Mary. John's second scene is very like that of Mark, of Luke rather. Jesus appears to the assembled community, speaks of peace, the gift of the Holy Spirit, forgiveness, and shares his mission with them. The element of doubt finds expression in the second part of the scene and focuses on Thomas, who learns to believe when he's invited to put his finger into the wounds that Jesus bore in his hands and put his hand into Jesus' pierced side. Is the text referring to an actual physical encounter? Does the risen body of Jesus have qualities like those that we now associate with our body, such that it can be touched? Or must we look deeper for John's meaning? Similarly with the scene in the appendix to John's Gospel. The disciples go back fishing, you might remember. Jesus appears on the shore and instructs them how to catch fish, and they are successful. Jesus is recognized, note, by the beloved disciple. The lover recognizes him. Peter swims ashore, and there's that intimate scene of reconciliation in which Jesus entrusts Peter with being the chief pastor of the flock. At the same time, we find this rather strange statement. It's John 21:12. None of the disciples was bold enough to ask who you are, or rather, who are you? They knew quite well it was the Lord. What is John asserting by this remark? It's obviously important to know how to read this literature in such a way as to enjoy the rich meanings that it conveys. Let's begin by examining what evidence we have as to the post-resurrection experiences had by Jesus' disciples. Jesus' disciples did not follow him all the way to the cross. They lost heart, they abandoned him, and they scattered. Yet shortly after his death, we find them together again in Jerusalem. We find them speaking openly and enthusiastically about Jesus, telling everyone that he's alive. In speaking like this, they ran up against the same opposition that had engineered Jesus' death, but they wouldn't be silenced. They stated clearly their conviction that the crucified Jesus had entered into life beyond death, the ultimate life with God. Furthermore, their preaching was convincing. History witnesses to the rapid and extraordinary growth and spread of Christianity. What happened to the disciples between their scattering and their coming together again? What did they experience that made such a powerful impression on them, gave them such courage and conviction, and carried them in their life through persecution and even martyrdom?